This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So President Biden's sit down with Clinton Foundation donor Zero. The extended play released yesterday. And he addressed the issues at the border, the challenges, not crisis. Oh, no. Issues, challenges, saying this is how they're dealing with an estimated 13,000 unaccompanied minors in essentially custody of border security.
So what we're doing is we're putting together an entire organizational structure so that within 7 days, they're able to get in the phone, contact that number, find out whether there is a mother or a father, whether it is safe, whether it is a secure circumstance to get the child to that adult.
So let me get this straight. He said that these kids, unaccompanied minors, come over. Most of them have a phone number attached to them. And so they're standing up operations to essentially phone a friend. They're doing a phone tree,
right,
to reunite unaccompanied minors at the border, unaccompanied on purpose so they could gain entry,
right,
with their parents in their home countries. That's new. That's a new one for me. I haven't heard that. Is that plausible?
I don't remember, because I've spent a lot of time on the border and with Border Patrol, seeing phone numbers pinned to people or in their pockets. I know that the Biden administration, they're sending back migrants and families, but allowing unaccompanied minors on a humanitarian grounds to stay. And that's why there's so many children, up to 13,000 unaccompanied children, because then they establish themselves. And then eventually when they get older, they bring their parents over.
So did that answer my question? That's a plausible approach. You just said that they're staying. So, if Joe Biden calls, don't answer the phone.
He's out of his mind.
They're sending
like a land of make-believe.
They're sending. Are these children organizing themselves and coming over in caravans, or they're being sent?
They're being sent.
Because people understand what the U.S. policy is at the border.
Mm-hmm.
So people understand, if I send my kid to America, I want my kid to have a better life in America. I'll send my kid. We'll figure out how to get there to reunite. But what we know is that the U.S. government will take care of my kid, that the kid will stay in U.S. custody, that will ultimately, potentially in the not too distant future, will provide a path to some sort of permanent legal status and ultimately citizenship for them. But the phone tree that Joe Biden set up is going to return. And then the logistics supporting that, even if you can get a hold of somebody, stay right there in Honduras or Guatemala or Haiti. We'll be right there with Junior.
Mm-hmm.
That's how this is going to play out.
And like, they have phones anyway inside their houses or whatever. It's such a joke. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, the layers of catastrophe here, Washington Examiner reporting, Paul Bedard, according to sheriffs on the border, in addition to the potential for lone wolf terrorists, COVID cases, which we talked a bit about, but here's the sheriff's estimate. These are people on the ground dealing with this on a daily basis. Estimates are that between 5 and 50% of the persons crossing without documentation are COVID positive. In any other construct, this is sheriff's statement, in any other construct, infection rates that high would be cause for alarm by public health officials. Yet we are currently engaging in policies that have potentially opened rather than restricted undocumented traffic in the United States, in addition to the 13,000 kids, 100,000 illegal migrants a month being apprehended at border authorities. You're 3x February of this year over February of last year.
Yeah. And these kids are going to drive up the positivity COVID rates in Texas, which is, targeted right now because they've been unmasked, for what, a week and a half, and their positivity, their rates dropped 42.5%. And now that's going to be just completely erased. No, it's
5 to 50% of the persons crossing are COVID positive. And what are the standards for reopening that the lockdowners, because we're talking about the same people, the open borders people are the lockdowners people.
Right.
What are their standards for allowing American citizens to resume the normal activities of their lives? What do the positivity rates have to be under?
Sometimes 3%. Yeah, they set these parameters, which are going to be blown out of the water now. And they're not letting us go see football games or professional games, but they're cramming 3,000 15 to 17-year-old kids into the Dallas Convention Center.
Forget what it will do to the overall infection rates. Your standard for American citizens, for people to send their kids back to school, is positivity rates under 3%. And yet you knowingly and willingly aid and abet a population to enter this country that, according to law enforcement, has positivity rates between 5 and 50%. But I understand COVID isn't political. Of course.
It's completely political.
In addition to that, something else that isn't political is the coverage of the story. That's not political, too. That's not political either. Right. This is an administration that doesn't believe the media is the enemy of the people. Right, because they're their friends. And is operating under a paradigm of transparency. So why can't reporters get access to these DHS facilities, these migrant detention centers?
Yeah, where kids are in cages. They let them in when Trump was in office, but they're not letting them in, or they're not even asking to come in while Biden's here.
Why can't they do ride-alongs with law enforcement? Well, that was a question posed to Jen Psaki, and this is her response.
Question about the situation on the border. It's now been 3 weeks since, I think, in this room you were first asked about getting us some press access. Why have we still not seen any images inside these facilities?
We remain committed to doing that, and I think these facilities are overseen. HHS, of course, oversees the shelters. The DHS oversees the Border Patrol facilities, and we want to work with them to ensure we can do it, respecting the privacy and obviously the health protocols required by COVID.
But even given COVID protocols and obviously privacy concerns, you know, even you all haven't released any images that you obviously could redact if you wanted to.
Again, we remain committed to sharing with all of you data on the number of kids crossing the border, the steps we're taking, the work we're doing to open up facilities, our own bar we're setting for ourselves and improving and expediting the timeline and the treatment of these children. And we remain committed to transparency. I don't have an update for you on the timeline for access, but it's certainly something we support.
Of course it does. We support this in principle. We're just not going to implement it. The COVID protocols, positivity rates of 5 to 50%. What are you talking about? COVID protocols?
There's no social distancing with 3,000 people in a convention center. What? COVID protocols? Oh.
And in terms of privacy?
Yeah.
Go to do a Google image search of Trump children in cages. I don't remember privacy concerns being raised by the press corps or the Democrat socialists that are in office and in power. You will find a ream, binders full of pictures of people, including children, in these detention centers, you know, in these areas that are cordoned off by chain link fencing and so forth. Yeah, you had a Time magazine cover based on these pictures with an imperious Trump, you know, 20 feet tall,
and a little
crying girl looking up at him with the headline, "This is America."
Yeah, welcome to America. It's all lies. And with the Biden administration, it's 20 times worse than this, guys. Kids are sleeping on the floors. They don't even have those Mylar blankets that they used to hand out. They've run out of those.
Now, by contrast, and this is, again, comparing and contrasting Trump administration policy to the first couple of months of Biden administration policy. Tucker Carlson sat down with the El Salvadorian president, Nayib Bukele. They talked about immigration. You know, this is one of the Northern Triangle countries that the Trump administration is working with to stem the flow of migrant caravans. And it was effective. Here's what the El Salvadorian president had to say. Contrast the El Salvadorian president with the pronouncements from the Biden administration. And you tell me, honestly, this question, who is doing a better job of advancing the interests of America? The El Salvadorian president or the one named Biden?
I just think that for a country, it's not profitable to get the people out. First, it's immoral. I mean, you need to provide for your people, right? That's the moral issue. But you also have an economic issue. If you send your hardworking people and your talented people and people that want to work and want to risk it just to go and work, you want to keep them here because those will be the drivers of your economy. You don't want them there so they could send a remittance, which would be a small portion of what they will earn and will they produce. You want them to produce here. But you're talking about problems that have been there, and not only in Salvador, but in a lot of countries in Latin America for the last four decades. And this immigration thing is just feeding on dependency on immigration on the countries that drive it. So it's not good for this, the United States, and it's not good for El Salvador. The best thing for both of us is to keep our people here and to provide for our people right here in our country. And that's what people here want.
So the El Salvadorian president is El Salvador first and America first, and Joe Biden is illegal immigrants first.
They're just trying to grow their Democratic Party. Phillip, change Texas blue.
Phillip on the northwest side. Phillip.
Hey, Phillip.
Sorry, guys. Good morning. Just got to work. Just started my truck. This is a race war and it's a continuation of NAFTA. They're going to pin the races against each other. Great show, by the way, because, you know, Jesus says beware of the money changers. Well, you take all the poor countries that have already changed the money, and you make us poor. You raise taxes, you bring these people in. You classify them as minorities, you put them on the dole. The white people are 8% of the world's global human population, and we're being drained out, but we're called racist when we say stop, cease, and desist, quit robbing us.
Well,
quit pinning all the races against each other. And you're abusing one group, and you're rewarding another group, and then 2 years later, they'll abuse another group and reward another group, and it just never stops. And the football game continues and continues, except it's economically destroying your country, destroying their country, and who's winning?
Well, thanks for the call. But you have the El Salvadorian president who wants to grow El Salvador, who wants to provide for El Salvadorians.
Such a noble.
And he can't
comment.
Get cooperation from America to make El Salvador great again. I mean, it's just the most remarkable thing. Jim in Crown Point.
I have a theory. How about this? These coyotes bring the people across. And there's a telephone number pinned to them. I'm saying it's the coyotes' number, and they're going to come to this country and hold them hostage, and the parents back in Mexico will be paying money for them. They said the cartel has abandoned cocaine, and they are doing the coyote move. They say they get between 10,000 and 20,000 a child. It's amazing.
They give them their whole life savings to have their kid have a better life.
Again, President AMLO of Mexico saying the cartels call President Biden the migrant president.
Mm-hmm.
It's breathtaking to me. No pictures, no photos.
It's all about COVID because they're hiding under COVID again.
No thinking, no bumping up what they're saying about the policy for Americans versus the policy for those entering this country illegally. I mean, it really is the unmaking of America. This policy is part of the unmaking of America.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about Biden's comments on the border and how we're going to return unaccompanied minors to their parents because we're going to call their parents and then reconnect them. That's the big plan. Yeah. He's setting up a phone tree at the federal level.
Yeah, and what do they think, that the parents are going to come and get him or wire him money to come home? No, that's not going to happen.
I'm sure with respect to his meeting in Alaska with the Chi-Coms to reset the relationship that America and China have, you know, the issue of perhaps taking some advice and counsel from the Chinese communists on how to deal with discrimination and hate crimes against Asian Americans in China will be on the docket. I hope he can get some good insights from a country committing genocide against its own people. How absurd. Everything forced through a racial prism, including by the president, including things that have nothing to do with race, like border policy. You can make it about race, but in terms of law enforcement and sensible policy, what we're talking about is colorblind. Greg and LaGrange, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning. It's of course it's not practical to do that. It's a complete diversion from the truth. They know that if they can flip Texas, it's just do the simple math on the big states, and it's just a matter of getting, what, 36 more electoral votes to win the national election. The problem is, and it's always been, a class war, and these people are a different class than you, and they will break you, and it's all about breaking us. It's all about breaking families. It's all about breaking us as the American public. It's breaking our kids at the expense of using other children as weapons against us, which is just completely as low as you can go in my book. There's really not much we can do here. I think what we can do is you have to punch yourself out of the corner, to use a Marvin Hagler type reference with his passing.
Yeah.
And fight your way out of the corner by punching away at your parents, punch away at your local school boards, fight your way out of the corner. And be resolved to the fact that one thing is true. You may not win in your lifetime, and I don't expect to, but if you quit, you'll never win, for not only in your lifetime, but your children's lifetime and your nieces, nieces, everything. You have to keep fighting. Fight out of the corner.
As Dan says, you always said, I'd rather live standing than... No, die standing than living on my knees.
That's right.
And that's so true.
And, you know, for the kids in cages, Trump, Luna, hysteric in your social circle, you know, preemptively raise these issues that we're discussing here. Why don't they want to see pictures? Aren't they concerned about the treatment of the kids and the people at the border? Why can't we get the president of the United States to cooperate with the El Salvadoran president, who wants to keep his hardworking people at home to build El Salvador? That's what he wants to do. He can't get cooperation from our president. Strange.
And President Biden yesterday, you know, this is his message to people that are thinking about coming here or sending their children.
Don't leave your town or city or community. The idea that Joe Biden said come, because I heard the other day that they're coming because they know I'm a nice guy and I won't do what Trump did.
They're saying this.
Yeah. Well, here's the deal. They're not.
That's just a repetition of what he's been saying, but it's not what he said. It's not the message that he has sent.
Right.
And continues to send. And the policy, the phone tree to reunite unaccompanied minors with their parents, I mean, that's just another green light that he just gave. It's because it's so preposterous as policy. The pronouncements from his spokes being only exacerbate it. Not only will they continue to green light people coming over, not only is a path of citizenship on the agenda for the fiscal year, but they're also going to do their best, you know, basically in cooperation with most of the press, to tamp down any uncomfortable pictures or information that might otherwise animate a larger swath of the American public than is currently animated by these issues, the way they were animated during Trump, but now have gone back to their stupor. And so here again, we have, since I brought it up, and mentioned it before Mike Scott's newscast. Mm-hmm. Now we're politicizing a guy who goes on a killing spree in Atlanta because he's white and the victims were Asian in these massage parlors that he frequented. And the conversation actually gets even dumber from there, including with law enforcement chiming in outside of their area of expertise. So it's hate crimes against Asian Americans that people who openly support the discrimination against Asian Americans when it comes to things like college admissions openly support it, openly hostile to Asian Americans, rallying to the defense, trying to force this of this tragedy, these killings, these murders in Atlanta through a racial prism again to try to, I don't know, buffalo Asian Americans into believing that they're on their side. You know, they're their protectors because they're another marginalized population. And then one of them tries to get into Harvard and they artificially lower that person's character score because they're so concerned about Asian Americans being marginalized. I mean, this is just so ridiculous. And just people prattle on about it. And the responses from people who are trying to provide the context that explains this, there's no indication this had anything to do with race.
Well, he even told officers. He said this isn't about, he said that he's suffering from a sex addiction.
Yeah.
And he wanted, he wanted to eliminate the temptations for him. And that's why he did it.
And as I said, then the conversation gets more asinine because we use sex addiction as a cover story for a murderer. One group wants to make it a hate crime, and the other idiotic group who lives in this therapeutic dreamland in this country, pharma-induced therapeutic dreamland, wants to make it about sex addiction. You know, that's the same thing as taking agency away from somebody to make them not accountable for what they did. He's a murderer.
And he's crazy.
Well here's, crazy.
Wait, that's if you go out and shoot eight women, Dan, no, there's some mental illness.
No, there's a predator. There's somebody who has no concern for other human beings. There's somebody who has no conscience. You don't mental issues. The armchair diagnoses. If you want to make diagnoses, then raise some actual scientific evidence to support your claim. These
I think people who are homicidal are crazy.
Well, and so just continue to repeat it.
People that commit murders have something wrong with them upstairs because normal people don't commit murders. And he did it because, again, you don't believe in sex addictions. I do. Here's the sheriff.
He has some issues, potentially sexual addiction, and may have frequented some of these places in the past. But as the chief indicated, it's still early on. We still have a lot of things to process.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And my point of contention was that everybody, our Asian American community, they're under attack, Biden, Harris, Lori Lightfoot, she even went on to blame, you know who, Orange Man Bad.
And this was a crime that has shown a harsh light on the anti-Asian violence and hateful rhetoric that has been on the rise since COVID-19 became a global pandemic and fanned by the hateful rhetoric of our former president in this country.
Trump's to blame now.
Just absolute asininity all the way around. From the sheriff to Lori Lightfoot. Different shades of it. You just repeat what somebody else told you. You repeat what a murderer told you. That must be why. She blames it on Trump because she's an identitarian hack. And law enforcement and the conversation more generally, nobody is intellectually curious. People throw around terms like addiction, the same way that people throw around terms with respect to COVID, like everybody's an epidemiologist now. Everybody's a board certified psychiatrist now, too. Really? Has anybody looked into the research on this? Because I thought we were all people of science and data. You know, there's research into this. Oh, Tiger Woods did this and David Duchovny did that. So what? That makes it scientifically sound, or it makes it a cover story for people that are high profile or people that are going to be charged with 8 murders to mitigate their circumstances. Oh, well, I looked at it. I you know, people can throw around their terms, and here's what I think because it came into my head, so it must be true. How hilarious. That's the hallmark of the sentimental barbarian. I feel so it's true. When UCLA researchers study the response to viewing sexually explicit images in people who self-defined as being unable to regulate their porn viewing, the results show no similar response in either brain measure to the response you see with respect to drugs, alcohol, smoking, gambling. Oh, we can make distinctions. People have actually asked these questions and looked into that. What a shock. One of the study's authors at UCLA, Nicole Prowse, said at a meeting of the Society of Personality and Social Psychology, I'm sure you were in attendance, Amy, that sex addiction misses another major hallmark of addiction, namely response to the addictive object over time. Specifically, people who develop addictions initially show high levels of response in the pleasure centers of the brain. Over time, as addiction takes hold, these parts of the brain no longer light up. In other words, one of the hallmarks of true addiction is that the pleasure received from the object of the addiction wanes over time as the person no longer wants the object, but rather needs the object. In contrast, even people who report very strong addiction to sex continue to show activation of the pleasure centers of the brain when viewing sexually explicit images. I'm sure all the armchair psychiatrists could distill that for me or present an alternative case study or an alternative theory because you've thought about this so deeply. Or you just watched some story on Entertainment Tonight about some Hollywood celebrity who said sex addiction is real. And then some murder in Atlanta says sex addiction is real. So I think sex addiction is real because a couple people said so. Paul in Waukesha, Wisconsin.
I have a question statement and a question for Amy. Amy, I just lost my train of thought.
Happens to me.
I want to have sex all the time with my. I want to have sex all the time with my wife. I'm going back. Does that make me a sex?
Well, do you miss work because of it? Do you stay home all the time? Is it affecting your?
Thanks for the call, Paul. That's interesting. Those aren't the indicators of addiction. Those are the indicators of a lack of self-control. That's not the same thing as addiction. Anthony Weiner was a sex addict too, right? And Elliot Spitzer. Everybody's a sex addict when they get caught doing something inappropriate. We'll find out that Andrew Cuomo was a sex addict when facing an impeachment trial, I'm sure. And people say, oh, he's a sex addict. Oh, he can't help himself. Oh, by the way, with respect to murderers, something is, you know, they're mentally wrong. There's also this other concept. We talk about it with terrorists, but I guess we've forgotten those conversations because some people have no institutional memory. There's this other concept called there is evil in this world. There are people with no conscience. There are people with no regard for other human beings. It's not a mental illness. It's evil. And you should call things what they are. Otherwise, you're polluting the language the same way the left does. Bill in LaSalle County.
Hey, Dan, Amy, thanks for taking the call. You just stole my thunder. That's exactly what I was going to say, because, Amy, I love you, but there's crazy and then there's evil. And under the same description, you could then say that John Wayne Gacy wasn't evil. He was just a sex addict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You create a cover story that absolves people of responsibility, of agency. They'll take it. Mike in Union.
Dan, you stole my thunder, too. But I was going to add on to Governor Cuomo's excuse of having a sex addiction is, just like Mayor Lightfoot said, you know, it's all because of COVID and Orange Man bad. That's why he did it. So you guys have a great day. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Whiteness is a pandemic. Whiteness is a pandemic. You're wondering what they were next going to classify a pandemic. Thought maybe it would be climate change. Try whiteness. That's Damon Young's view. Damon Young writes at The Root with other racial demagogues like Michael Harriot. He's also a contributor to the New York Times. Of course he is. Whiteness is a public health crisis. It shortens life expectancies. It pollutes air. It constructs equilibrium. It devastates forests. It melts ice caps. It sparks and funds wars. It flattens dialects. It infects consciousness. And it kills people. White people and people who are not white, my mom included. There will be people who die in 2050 because of the white supremacy-induced decisions from 1850. A line can and should be drawn from the actions of the white supremacists who stalked into three Atlanta area massage parlors yesterday and allegedly killed eight people to the relentless anti-Asian rhetoric pollinating national discourse over the past year. Mm-hmm. The former president can and should be blamed for this, mm-hmm. and the sudden increase of racist violence against Asian Americans. Doesn't stop there, though. It extends back 400 years and has tentacles clawing everywhere white supremacy exists here in America, which is everywhere. There's a line connecting this act of terror to the 11 people killed at the Tree of Life Synagogue in 2018 and the 9 people killed at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in 2015, of course, but also to gentrification, to redlining, to racial profiling, to gerrymandering, to voter oppression, to mass incarceration, to the war on drugs, to the subprime mortgage crisis, to the vast disparities in both COVID deaths and who receives COVID vaccinations, to how the men and women who stormed the Capitol just went home and had dinner with their families afterwards while we were still processing and recovering from what we witnessed. White supremacy is a virus that, like other viruses, will not die until there are no bodies left for it to infect, which means the only way to stop it is to locate it, isolate it, extract it, and kill it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
You know who agrees with that?
Who?
You know who agrees with Damon Young? Naperville Unified School District 203 Superintendent Dan Bridges. And apparently the school board in Naperville 203.
Vote them out August 6th. I'm sorry, April 6th.
They don't use the same language that Mr. Young uses, but it's the same position. They just use sort of the flowery, pseudo-intellectual language of the anti-racist movers and shakers. The Ibram Kendis, don't call me Henry Rogers, and Robin DiAngelo's of the world, who they bring in, and their acolytes, who they bring in and spend your money to indoctrinate your kids. Dan Bridges, the superintendent of Naperville School District 203, believes whiteness is a pandemic, too. Here's his defiant statement of the school district's first principal.
Good afternoon. I'm back with another installment of 203 and 203. Today I'm addressing some concerns we have heard with community reaction to our recent Countywide Equity Institute training. Naperville 203 has publicly committed to creating a diverse and inclusive environment for our students and staff. We've done this with the hiring of an executive director of diversity and inclusion, drafting of a comprehensive equity plan and the corresponding work, and ultimately through a Board of Education resolution reaffirming District 203's commitment to equity for all students, overcoming systemic racism, and ending racial injustice. Despite Naperville 203's overall high academic achievement patterns, we are aware of persistent racial, ethnic, and economic-related disparities and inequities in our students' learning and comprehensive school experiences.
Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. The implications are the same. Damon Young is just more honest about his position. Oh, for those who disagree with Superintendent Bridges, that won't be tolerated. Again, the Orwellian language that conveys the same thing.
We are committed to this work, and we will not tolerate hateful comments and threats. While everyone is entitled to their own opinions, threats to the safety of our staff or presenters will never be tolerated. This is unacceptable. Naperville 203 is supporting teachers and other staff in building their capacity to create inclusive learning environments where all students are represented, have equitable access, can meaningfully participate in all aspects of teaching and learning.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know it was so bad in Naperville.
Will not tolerate any threats means no dissent. That's what that actually means. We're free to have a different opinion. No, you're not. You can't be free to have another opinion. You know why? Because every opinion has to be, and every policy is either racist or anti-racist. That's what the philosopher kings, Dan Bridges is leaning on, say. That's the celebrated Ibram Kendi's work. The Manichaean binary. Racist or anti-racist? Everything is. Race informs every opinion and every policy, and it is in one of two buckets. That's it. And then if you're in the racist bucket, what comes next? You've been paying attention. You can complete the sentence, right? What comes next? It's not an anti-racist view. It's not an anti-racist policy. Therefore, it's a racist view. It's a racist policy. And you know what that is? That's violence. That's a threat.
And then the cancel culture.
I don't feel safe. That dissent has to be stifled. This is paint by number stuff, folks. So my question to Naperville 203 parents, particularly the men, to the extent there's any significant number of non-limp noodles in that town left. If your kid was being physically abused, you unquestionably wouldn't tolerate it. But you celebrate or are willfully blind to his or her intellectual abuse? Do I have that right? Or is that too harsh? You're turning over your kid's intellectual development to the Chardonnay Antifa, to the Apple Teeny Meanies. And I'm talking about the men. Forget the coven of Anna Stava Murray supporters in places like Naperville. Yeah, the socialists that you elected as state rep. You know who I'm talking about. What is it? What's the verdict? Because Dan Bridges wants the healing to begin, which is their version of a declaration of war. Whatever they're indicating their end is, you can assume it's 180 degrees the opposite.
The next phase of this learning is to increase discourse among staff, to understand diverse perspectives, and determine the next steps in our learning plan based on the needs of all stakeholders. Equity work can be uncomfortable, and we expect that. It is how we respond to it that matters. Even when uncomfortable, it is through open dialogue that healing and change will begin.
Oh, let the healing begin in Naperville. Ibram Kendi, there is no such thing as a not racist idea, only racist ideas and anti-racist ideas. Just for the citation, in case anybody's confused. What about it? Naperville.
Good community.
Great schools in Naperville. Well, as we talked about, since very few parents are willing to speak up, I know some are, but relative to the size of the population, and frankly, the sense of urgency about what's happening, the most impressive person I've seen in this whole discussion, and we've had the PowerPoint of their racist indoctrination curriculum that we discussed previously, in addition to their COVID hysteria. I mean, the Naperville School District has behaved like the Chicago Public School District for most of the pandemic, haven't they?
Oh, yeah.
The most impressive person I've heard from in Naperville, not an adult, eighth grader, Jay Deegan, who's got more stones than apparently
the men in the community.
The entirety of them.
Hello, my name is Jay Deegan. My address is 9th Lane,
and I am an 8th grader at Kennedy Junior High. At the November board meeting, I shared with you how I was frustrated with e-learning following the implementation of the block schedule. Today, I plan to speak about that again and how I didn't agree with the block schedule, how I didn't agree with the hybrid plan, and how I wanted to be in full-time 5 days a week. But then, when I came here, I saw that you guys were not letting everybody in who were standing outside. And about halfway through this,
they have to clap for the 8th grader because they can't speak for themselves.
I thought, you know what, I should revise my speech. So, you know, I just thought about it all in my head. And I remember in about 2011-ish, when you guys were redrawing the boundaries, you guys had the board meeting for the big one in the auditorium right over there, where I think there's over 2,500 people capacity, okay? And I don't understand why you cannot do this when redrawing boundaries is minuscule compared to the risk of child's education and people being back in school. So I have two options. I'm going to recommend to you guys next meeting, you guys should go out either in that massive stadium right there if you guys are afraid about COVID, because by then the temps will warm up. There's a nice sound system there. Or you can go in the auditorium. Putting people in a mid-sized room, okay, with only 25 capacity and not letting people's voices be heard is horrible. You are silencing our freedom of speech. You are silencing the Open Meetings Act by not letting anybody who wants to come in here, in here. The person over there, the man, he said, oh, when one person leaves, another person can come in. Then they just reversed that. You called the cops on people who wanted to speak and who wanted to tell you that you guys are doing a horrible job and you are putting our education at risk. You know what? I thought I put trust in you guys at the beginning. And now I just see that you guys are a bunch of, you are just a sham of a school board. I hope you guys don't get reelected at all. And I hope, Dan Bridges, I hope you resign.
On behalf of the whole board, thank you for your comments, Jay.
Has anybody in Naperville called out Dan Bridges other than that 8th grader, for God's sakes? Can anybody in Naperville take off their pee hat and give us a call, please? How pathetic. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Yeah, good morning. This is exactly why all these districts need to be broken up into one district per school building. You have these superintendents and these boards that control way too much. They destroy way too many people's lives. You know, 203 has its unified district. It is like, I think, 7 or 8 school districts. The leftists can't control 8 of them, not in, even in that neighborhood. And then, you know, 214 should be 6 or 7 districts. So it should be. You have more parents. Not all of them would be, you know, amenable to these leftist ideas. That's what has to happen. That's what happened before. In the 50s and 60s, you had 10,000 districts in Illinois. More democracy will solve this.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Frank. Although, arguably, we have the second most number of school districts in the country, and obviously the fifth, soon sixth largest population. And all those school districts are what? Units of government that do what? Confer salaries and pensions. Part of our financial problem here. So I hear what you're saying in terms of sort of the subsidiary argument, but I think it's a little bit more complicated than that.
We have 859 school districts in Illinois, and Florida has what, 69?
They're under 80.
I mean, hello.
I mean, if these schools were standalones in Naperville, do you think it would be any different?
No.
You just have more Dan Bridgeses too on top of it, I suspect. Oh, by the way, speaking of Florida, Ron DeSantis, the governor there, he's got a different view on the critical race theory that people in this state region
should hear.
Just a different view than people in this state and region just readily accept from charlatans like Dan Bridges.
Florida's civics curriculum will incorporate foundational concepts with the best materials, and it will expressly exclude unsanctioned narratives like critical race theory and other unsubstantiated theories.
Oh, yeah. You can clap.
The anti-racist equity claptrap you hear from purveyors of dreck like 203 Superintendent Dan Bridges is intellectual fraud. Don't believe me. Read John McWhorter, Columbia University professor of linguistics. Read Coleman Hughes, another young, really good black writer, also Ivy League educated. Read our friend Charles Love, used to be part of the Right in Black show before he moved to New York. That was a bad move. But what, not getting out of Chicago, but landing in New York, of course. He has a great piece in City Journal out yesterday. Progressive against civil rights. This is so great. This is perfect. Taking the premise to its logical and, in this case, because it's intellectual fraud, absurd conclusion. Today's advocates, he writes, see things this way. What America needs is not equality, but equity. You just heard it from Bridges. A concept that trades the old notion of colorblindness for an obsessive focus on race. And it requires the race-conscious redistribution of power from whites to underrepresented minorities. Those two concepts are contradictory, and a careful examination of those demands bumped up against the language of the 1964 Civil Rights Act leads to the conclusion that those demanding equity should demand that the 1964 Civil Rights Act be repealed. And he's exactly right. So put that to Dan Bridges. Maybe Jay Deegan, the eighth grader, will put it to Dan Bridges, since nobody else in Naperville seems courageous enough to do so, and to the teachers there. Based on what I learned from Dan Bridges's two-minute propaganda riff, we should support the repeal of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, right, teacher? Let's do a class project. Let's get petitions circulating to repeal the 1964 Civil Rights Act. You know, let's attach real-world implications and activism to the positions we're being told to take by our educators. Jeff in Wakanda.
Hey, guys. Just wanted to stick up for some of the educators. I listen to you guys every morning and sometimes feel beat up. I've been going in every day. We got kids back as soon as we could. We are held to some pretty high restrictions and guidelines. And I just want you to know that there are teachers out there that are working hard, and there's principals out there working hard. And not everybody is Chicago. So I'm just calling in to stick up for some of my people and let you guys know that there are places out in Illinois doing the best they can.
Oh, I know that. Thanks for the call, Jeff. I got it.
Thanks for working.
But it's not Naperville. Forget Chicago. That's an easy one. How about Naperville?
They're still closed.
How about Glen Ellyn? How about Highland Park and Deerfield? Still closed. How about so many of these suburban school districts that are doing the same thing?
Evanston, yeah.
Yeah. How about Skokie, Evanston?
Same thing. They're never going to reopen.
I'm on the record, so you can Google or DuckDuckGo writings that op-eds I published over the years and years ago. So this whole like, oh, you're anti-teacher, you're anti-educate, right? I'm anti-teacher, I'm anti-education. Please, let's spare me the need to qualify and assault on ignorance with. But I recognize there are some who are not ignorant. Of course I do. I said in writing 15 years ago, I've said on the show before, I'll say again, a great teacher is like a great artist. I believe that. I had great teachers. I went to good schools. Even Northwestern 25 years ago was decent. You still had to do your outside reading to get, you know, a more complete understanding of any particular topic outside of STEM, but it was still challenging because you have smart kids there that weren't as PC-addled then, although many were, as they are today. What I want to hear is not Jeff from Wakanda calling to say, there are good people, I'm a good person, I'm a good principal, our teachers at Wakanda, wherever he teaches, are good teachers and so forth. Yeah, I get it. I got it. Stop being so defensive. You know what you should be doing if you wanted to be helpful? Get on offense with me. Don't address what you're doing specifically other than to put it in context to say, I agree with you about Naperville. Bridges is wrong. What they're doing in these school districts is wrong. what they're doing in these school districts is intellectual child abuse. How about that? If you want to separate yourself from the Dan Bridges of the world, and I'm going to continue saying his name as often as I can, if you want to separate yourself from charlatans, hucksters, music men like Dan Bridges, then stand up and be counted. For what you're doing, sure, fine. For what they're doing, too. I'm not the one impugning your reputation by association. Dan Bridges is.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Pick a perfect bracket, win $1 million in our March Mayhem contest. Learn more and enter at 560theanswer.com/mayhem.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I just love the lockdowners pretending that they're reasonable because some no longer want to man the unreasonable position. They just can't serve as a sentinel for that post anymore. Jonathan Chade in the New Yorker, just reopen the schools now. Oh, right. The leftists all coming around, all frustrated, starting to do a better job of reading the tea leaves of where public opinion is with respect to schools that are slow walking their reopening. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, relying on Americans, at least most Americans, to have no memory of the last year and who was where and who said what, just to be relieved and happy and satisfied when schools do reopen. We'll celebrate it all together, even though we were the responsible party for shutting it down. We'll just paper over that.
Yeah. It's like, you know, somebody locks you in a trunk, and then when they let you out of the trunk, you hug your captor. It's so stupid. And parents who are, well, not that anyone's aggressively fighting for our kids to get back in school, but there are a select few. School is not school. We're fighting for, what, 2 days? Ooh, wow. Where they can't breathe and they have to sit in the same spot and wear two masks probably. Main Township's doing double masks in order to go back. You think that that's not going to come and creep into CPS? Of course it is.
Well, there's double masks in Maine Township, and there's one Vandalia High School senior down in Southern Illinois who is pushing in the other direction. Here again, we have to rely on the young people, grade schoolers and high schoolers, to do what adults won't do, exhibit some courage. Listen to what she had to say at a board meeting.
I would like to smile at you because of my mat, but because of my mask, you cannot see it. My name is Taylor Dothiger, and I'm a senior here at Vandalia. On Thursday, March 11th, I made a post on Snapchat about doing a No Mask Monday. Wow. Students were very quick to join me, and the school immediately threatened everyone with suspension if we did. Miss Kruger was looking out for me and made sure my dad was aware that I was the ringleader. She suggested I approach you guys, the school board. So here I am. My post on Snap was deleted, but I am learning the waves that my post made. It was shared all over Facebook, and I don't even have a Facebook account. I know you, our superintendent, and all the teachers are looking out for the best interest in us students, but I want to provide a voice for the student body. We are begging for the option to mask or mask not. My body and my choice.
Of using the left's rhetoric against them, very good. And she went on to offer examples of what's happened, even that those just anecdotes that she knows locally. Some girl playing basketball in Carlisle in the region who collapsed because she was wearing a mask while playing basketball and so on and so forth. Gave a lot of good examples.
Because you're depleting your body of oxygen. Hello, doctors and scientists out there. Dr. Ezekiel, IDPH. Well, they're the ones who are making mask mandates for the state of Illinois.
I understand the wearing mask while playing sports or working out is absolute lunacy. Just lunacy. But that's where we're at. She did generate a response from one school board member,
okay,
the young lady you heard from, the senior at Vandalia High School. a board member there named Joe Lawson offered this. He was reasonable measure. They seem to be a little bit more commonsensical in Southern Illinois than they do up here where all the urban sophisticates live.
I think behind the scenes, several of us have worked through the governor's office to try and persuade IDPH and CDC and Governor Pritzker to lighten up on the mask mandates and find that, like you many times, not have a lot of common sense behind it. And yet, at this stage of getting our kids back in school, and I believe being in school 5 days a week fights depression and anxiety a lot more than no mask would, that we're making some inroads. And I don't want to risk that in our sports attendance, which is good for the community, by pushing on the mask issue at this time. That's but great. The board will talk and will consider that, and we'll take it very seriously.
So that,
as we do everything else, and I really appreciate all the research you've done. Thank you for that.
Yeah, she cited a lot of scientific studies in her statement as well. It was very good. Again, there's some student, independent study that this should be a school project she gets credit for, the 15-minute statement she made to the board. But so Joe Lawson there, that school board member, it's a reasonable position. I get what he's saying. He starts from the right place. Mm-hmm. He's like, we're trying to work this out. It's a balancing act because
can't have fans at games without wearing masks.
Well, it's a balancing act in terms of the level of defiance. And everybody has a different risk tolerance and makes perhaps a different assessment on what is likely to come. They're trying to push on the governor's office to relax some of the mask mandates, as you heard him say. They're worried that the progress that they've made mm-hmm. will be lost if they just act in open defiance.
Well, they did act in open defiance with letting more than the suggested amount of fans in to watch basketball games, but they still socially distanced and still wore masks, and I respect them for that because who's going to arrest them? And that's what one of the county sheriffs said. They're in Fayetteville County. He said, my kids play sports. I'm going to their game. I'm not going to arrest anybody. These are just things that Pritzker puts out there that they expect people to follow.
Yeah, and so, which is where I was getting to. I mean, we had this with the restaurants, too, and the defiance of restaurants. I mean, we got the whole Rebel Lunch Club that Tom Sedaka and others started here in Chicago Metro, patronizing restaurants that said we're not shutting down, and the local officials backed them and said we're not arresting them. We're not sending police to shut them down either. And it just went on because enough people stood up. And so that would be my response to Joe Lawson. I think he's a reasonable guy, commonsensical guy. He's trying to make a judgment call. The board is okay, fine. We can have an intelligent conversation. But here's the thing. What are they going to do when you say, if both parents want to come to watch a sporting event their kid's involved in, then both parents can come. If grandma wants to come too, then grandma can come. We're not limiting to one person per family. Are the spectators. And also, with respect to masks, no masks, we're going to do our own thing. And maybe our leadership will build a broader consensus. And our local officials are going to back us. Law enforcement is not going to serve as some hatchet squad for Jelly Belly. And we're going to do our own thing. That's another approach. And I think at this stage, that's the right approach. I understand why he wants to be measured, but I think more civil disobedience is the order of the day at present. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Fayetteville County, guess how many active cases they have? No hospitalizations, just cases of COVID.
Fayette County?
Fayette County. Nine.
Right, exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Exactly. Let's use some common sense here, people. And they've been back in school, and they've had no significant spread. I just don't know how we got to this point. And now, we should be in phase five, and then today Pritzker is going to say, oh, we're going to have 4.5 phase, but don't think you're going to get rid of your masks anytime soon. And Biden said the same thing yesterday. He said, we're going to wear masks. I urge all local doctors and ministers, priests to talk about why it's important to get vaccinated. Because we are going to be wearing these masks until everyone is vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? That's never going to happen. Because not everyone wants to be vaccinated.
Are you really going to allow your governor and or your school district to say mom or dad can attend Junior's sporting event? Really?
Well, at least they have that. And CPS is not letting parents go to outdoor baseball games or soccer games or football games.
Well, it's just the same question.
Right.
Are you really going to be prohibited from attending Junior's game? No, or are you going to allow one parent, one family member, from being able to attend on behalf of your family member who's participating in said sporting event? Are you really going to do that?
We had a volleyball game yesterday, and all the parents sat in their cars in the parking lot while we played our game.
So the answer is
so
yes.
Stupid. Well, it's like, well, I told the parents, if you ever want to get involved, now it's affecting you. Now it's affecting your household. So do something about it. Call this number. I gave them a number to call if you want to see your kids play sports in Chicago, because they could have easily have spread out in that gym. There's only 10 of them there.
John and Marengo.
Stupid.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. Nice to finally talk to you. So I live in Marengo, and I don't know if you know this, but Marengo School, we closed down for, you know, when the pandemic started last year, you know, for that couple months or whatever. But the start of this year, we're all in school, you know, they had their choice. I think it's something like 70-30 that's in, you know, 70% of the schools in school right now.
Good.
From the very beginning. It was a big fight with his mom, but luckily I have custody, so I put my foot down so that he went to school. But it was, you know, certainly no kids dropping dead in the street, and there hasn't been an influx of COVID cases throughout the school, so... You know, I think it's time to open up.
Like everywhere else in the Western world. Thanks for the call, John. Jerry in Naperville.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Grew up in Naperville, moved there in the 70s. And, I mean, what's happening is totally predictable. It's happening all over the country. It's like Martians fleeing a planet on which they've ruined all the resources.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter's been in school since mid-August in Naperville. She goes to a Catholic school. It's perfect. It's just, I mean, Dan Bridges is not the problem. He's a symptom.
Understood. But he's the superintendent, so let's start there and include everybody else who should be included. Thanks for the call, Jerry. Including the school board members. Absolutely. Everybody. It should be a full meeting on the intellectual battlefield of everybody who is intellectually abusing kids in Naperville 203 and everywhere else. And you want to test them? Oh, hey, Bridges? Oh, you got this idea? Tell you what, you want to have a dialogue? Tell you what, I'm going to outsource my dialogue time to John McWhorter. Parents are going to get together. We're going to have John McWhorter from Columbia come in and address these issues. Or we're going to fly Bob Woodson in and address these issues on our behalf. Give a perspective. You know, Bob Woodson, he was part of the civil rights movement. Shelby Steele, we're going to bring him in. Mm-hmm. You ready to have that dialogue? Really want a dialogue? No, you don't. We know. Nick in Hinsdale.
Hey, just wanted to say, can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we hear you.
My son has a big football game tomorrow at Hinsdale Central. It's hard getting tickets. I have friends that we're playing Oak Park at Hinsdale Central, and my son's got to wear a mask the whole game. I said, you mean on the sideline? No, when I'm out on the field, when I'm catching the ball, I have to wear a mask. And I said, well, where do you put your mouthpiece? Like, do you have the mouthpiece that's attached to the,
helmet? Yeah.
He said, no, they won't let us wear. We have to wear a mouthpiece without this rubber. Yeah, it's a joke. It's really a shame. And you can't even get the kids from Oak Park. Their families want to come to the game. They can't come.
Well, just rebel. I mean, seriously, you need to get a group of people and storm the field. That's what we're doing. And I don't care if I get arrested. I'm ready. I'm done. I'm done playing nice. I'm done following the rules because they have abused us.
Although
it's sickening and stupid. Or you can get a cherry picker, remember?
Although I got to say, I'm not a big fan of Hinsdale, Nick, as I'm sure you know. But but at least you get a reprieve from having to be exposed to people from Oak Park. That's even worse.
Yeah, there you go.
They're on the opposing side. You won't even run into them. I mean, they could have a separate entrance, which they do, for visitors from the away team. No one's exercising common sense.
Mike in Yorkville.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, you know, I'm just so glad I'm one of the natives of society that was able to work
during this whole time during the supposed pandemic, but yet government workers have some ability not to be able to go to work and get paid in full, while I know people that didn't have jobs and they had to go file for unemployment because they either chose to go ahead and not work or their companies let them go. But here, I have to go continue to keep working to pay into the government pigs of society that keep on getting fat because I'm keeping on paying into a tax system that pays these people not to work. Yeah. I'm so happy to be one of these people. No right. wonder why the people, the good, hardworking people of Illinois that are very skilled people, leave this state.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, it's a real mystery. Paul in New Lenox.
Hi, guys. Yeah, ever since I retired a year and a half ago, I've been substitute teaching in Frankfort, New Lenox, and Manhattan. And it's like, why are the suburban schools all open? The Chicago schools, oh, fear is a big motivator. So, yes, we do have to wear masks, and the kids have been conditioned to that. But for the learning experience from a year and a half ago when I first started teaching, the kids have gone, what they've learned from the year before till now, they're going to need a lot of help. Oh, yeah. So I've got to say.
Thanks for the call, Paul.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Join prospective Illinois governor candidates Gary Rabine, Darren Bailey in the McHenry County GOP for Freedom Friday on March 26th to learn about the upcoming 2022 election and to showcase the importance of our First and Second Amendments. Tickets are only available through this Friday, folks. That's tomorrow for $50. So buy now before they sell out. Tickets include dinner and cash bar that starts at 6 p.m. at DeAndre's Banquets in Crystal Lake. For all the details and to secure tickets, see the get the link at AM560Social, AM560Social, or visit is.gd/freedom2022.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, for all that.
Oh, you're busy filling out your brackets right now, because that's what I'm doing as well.
I got to do that before.
I know, before 11 a.m.
Yeah, although the playing games, I don't think you fill out in the brackets.
Okay.
At least not the CBS Sports one that we're doing here. But anyway, I digress. So how do we keep the fear going? It's a real conundrum for the lockdowners and the TV docs and so forth. How do you do it? Chuck Todd perhaps gave an indication of how you might in his interview earlier this week with Saints Tony Fauci.
And I know there's a lot of folks who think that, you know, due to climate change and due to the globalization in general, it's inevitable we're going to deal with more and more viruses like this.
So there you go. There's your support for more restrictive policies, dare I say, continuation of lockdown policies to combat climate change, which is not far down the list of the Biden administration's agenda. That's one way to keep the fear going. We have to do these things in the name of climate change to protect more viral outbreaks, very much like one of the overstated arguments about climate change in support of draconian policies is that climate change was producing more and more violent major weather events, tornadoes, typhoons, hurricanes. And actually, the data doesn't really support that, much less make a causal link. But that's OK. We got to be scary. You know, that's why in Hollywood helped. Remember all those movies about, major weather events about the time that they were trying to promote this idea that climate change is going to result in
water world.
Well, yeah.
Remember
that? Well, yeah. Hundreds, hundreds of thousands of deaths in one fell swoop, a la the typhoon in Phuket and in the Far East from several years back. That's going to be a regular occurrence. Well, that hasn't panned out, but that's okay. They have more tricks up their sleeve. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Bjorn Lomborg. He's the president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank. He's also the author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. It's great to be back.
Before we get to some of your recent observations, the thing that Chuck Todd did there in trying to, and by the way, Fauci didn't dispute the premise of his question, the idea that climate change will induce more viral outbreaks a la COVID-19. Scientific evidence to support that?
That seems to be very slight. I mean, look, any kind of change will make some things worse and some things better. And it's very easy for people to only fixate on the things that'll get worse. And, you know, that's not necessarily a bad idea because we want to, you know, make sure we actually fix everything. But the idea that just everything is going to get worse with climate change and that everything will be harder when we get climate change is just simply wrong. And one simple way of thinking about it is, look, there's going to be more heat deaths and there's going to be more fewer cold deaths with climate change. How many cold deaths are there for every heat death? There's actually 17 cold deaths around the world for every one heat death. At least in the short and medium term, it's actually going to be a net advantage. This does not mean that there's not a problem with heat death, but just and only counting one part of it is a very bad way to influence us. It's actually only a way to scare us.
That is the sort of measured opinion that almost got you disinvited from presenting at Duke University. You can't be running around saying things like this.
I know. There's a number of professors from Duke University who literally said, I should not be allowed to make an academic presentation at Duke like everyone else does to tell you what is actually what the UN climate panel is telling you. I'm not, you know, some raving eye mad guy running around and saying there's no such thing as climate change. Look, I'm taking my starting point in the UN climate panel. I think we are entitled to know the full truth. That is, yes, there is a problem. Yes, overall, global warming is something we should fix. But also, we need to know, as I just mentioned, that there's both ups and downs, and need to know the size of this. So the UN climate panel actually tells us in about 50 years, the impact of global warming, if we do nothing, is equivalent to losing somewhere between 0.2 and 2% of our income every year. That's not a nothing. But remember, by then, the UN estimate will be 363% as rich as we are today. So that literally means instead of being 363% as rich, we'll only be 356% as rich. Yes, that's a problem. No, it's not the end of the world.
Well, what about all these countless lives that are being lost to climate-related disasters worldwide?
So people think, and I understand why, because you see all these hurricanes hit a lot of different places, and the feeling you get is, oh my God, this is getting worse and worse. There's two things that actually counteract that. One of the reasons is, of course, that we are much more technologically developed. Everybody knows that there is a hurricane coming, unlike the world's biggest hurricane death back in Bangladesh in 1971, where more than 300,000 people died, mostly because they had no idea it was coming. We have much better technology, and the reason why you see much more of this is actually because of the CNN effect. You know, there's a camera everywhere that shows you this. So if you actually look at the number of dead from all kinds of climate-related disasters, it used to be 100 years ago, about 500,000 people died every year. This last decade, about 18,000 people died. Despite, you know, global populations quadrupling, fewer and fewer people are dying from weather-related disasters related to climate. Not because there's no climate change, but simply because we've gotten richer and are much better able to handle it. You are getting the wrong information if you only think, oh, my God, I see more and more hurricanes on CNN. Hence, it must be more and more dangerous. No, it's not.
Yeah, the other thing, I like your emphasis on this from a lot of your work, and we've talked about this a number of times, but I always believe it bears repeating. Those who pretend to speak on behalf of the poor and the marginalized, not just in the West, but the world over. It's very much like the lockdowner policies, despite the UN food programming exec Beasley saying, don't lock down your countries because you're going to cut our supply chains and 30 million people more are going to starve than do on an annualized basis already. The UN convoy on COVID, UN envoy, excuse me, on COVID talking about it's the same thing because we need our convoys of food to be able to get to where the food is needed. And that was ignored. And so the same here, the policies that are being advanced by, frankly, many of the same people also disproportionately impact the developing world, the poorest people in the land. This isn't about, they want to make this about, oh, you know, Dan doesn't want his marginal income tax to go up 2 percentage points to pay for climate change policies and so on and so forth. No, I mean, I don't, but because it's terrible policy for me and for everybody else, and the everybody else gets lost in this discussion.
Yeah. So fundamentally, if you ask the world's poor, and not surprisingly, they actually care about the fact that their kids might die tonight from easily curable infectious diseases, that they don't have enough food, that they don't get a good education. Those are the kinds of things they really want us to focus on. And one of the ways to tackle that, of course, is to make sure that there's robust growth, much of which is powered by a lot of available and cheap energy. Much of that will come from fossil fuels. The simple point is, when people are saying the best way to help the people in the developing world is by not driving my car today and emitting a little less CO2, it seems a little bit like, you know, let them eat cake kind of argument. It's the way that you're saying, I'm going to help them a tiny bit in 100 years, instead of focusing on helping them a lot right now when they need it. This does not mean global warming is not a problem. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do smart stuff, but it simply means we need to get a sense of proportion and make sure we don't, in order to fix the thing that everybody in the rich world cares so much about, climate change, that we forget all the obvious things like people dying from tuberculosis and malaria.
Yeah, that order of magnitude perspective you provide is always useful. And there's just so many examples. You give a good one in a recent piece you wrote that was posted at Fox News. I think that's where I saw it, foxnews.com, about the coverage of the wildfires in Australia. And the perspective that, you know, Australia is being burned to the ground, when in point of fact, no, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. Look, again, there was very extreme fires, especially in New South Wales and Victoria, where a lot of people live, which is why this was a local real disaster. It was something that was relevant to report. But that was not the tragedy that most people heard about. Most people heard that the Australian continent was a blaze, and I'm quoting several headlines, it was a blaze because of global warming. But actually, Australia burnt one of the lowest levels. That is, you know, it only burnt about 4% of its area in 2019-20, which is very much less than the 6% in this century and the more than 10% it usually burned in the last century. It was a very low level, and it was counter to what most climate models would tell us, because climate models would tell us it should actually burn more. So yes, there was localized catastrophes, and definitely we should be aware of those, but it was not this Australia's ablaze. Actually, Australia experienced one of its lowest burn ever. And that again tells you, you need to not just listen to the scary rhetoric, you need to listen to the data.
Yeah, well, and it was the same distorted reporting with respect to the California wildfires too. Yeah. He is Bjorn Lundberg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus Think Tank, author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn, thanks as always.
Dan, great to talk.
And also, too, I don't know, did you see the picture of the climate czar, John Kerry? He was on American Airlines sitting in first class reading a book, no mask on, and he wasn't eating or drinking. And so now American Airlines is actually investigating to see what they should do is what they do to every other passenger. If you take your mask off,
senseless.
No, you're kicked off for life. Not from that flight. You can't fly them again. Same with Delta.
I'd like to see him dragged off a flight like Dr. David Dow. I would like to see
Nico
that.
Go home.
But
you've got to go home.
But you know, but then the flip side is, hey, we should be thankful that he deigned to fly commercial.
Oh, right.
And
such a plebeian move.
It taking his mask off so we can recognize who our betters are among us.
Unbelievable. Check it out. It's on Twitter. Bjorn, by the way, joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You remember way back in 2019,
yeah,
one of the first books that came out on the Trump presidency, Michael Wolff, formerly of The Hollywood Reporter and GQ, his book, Siege, Trump Under Fire. And when he was doing the promotional tour for his book, some of the fact-checking of some of the things that were in his book was starting. And there were some real questions about his sourcing of things that were asserted in his book. And he famously said, in response to the criticism about things that are in the book that couldn't be substantiated or were the substantiation was, you know, dubious in some way, he said, well, if it sounds true, it probably is.
Oh, yeah. You've heard that before.
But he was ridiculed for that. In fact, Michael Wolff has sort of disappeared from the journalistic landscape, as far as I could tell, since that book came out. Maybe he made so much money from it with all those champagne socialists buying up his book, he didn't need to hang around anymore. But if it sounds true, it probably is. That was ridiculed in 2019. That is now should be on the masthead, right where a Democracy Dies in Darkness is currently on the Amazon Post. If it sounds true, it probably is. And by that, he means, well, you know, that's if it reflects your view, it's probably true. And so that was the standard that the Washington Post used to cover President Trump and his and the whole find the fraud, according to anonymous sources that made its way into the arguments of the House impeachment managers during House impeachment, during, well, impeachment, House and Senate 2.0. Of course, it wasn't true because of the, what we talked about earlier this week, the audio file that was recovered by the investigator in question here. Trump never told that person to find the fraud. Didn't say anything of the sort. In point of fact, what he said runs counter to the impression you're left with if he had said find the fraud. Is there a mea culpa? No. And it's not limited to Trump. And the examples are concurrent. Ryan T. Anderson, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, who wrote the book When Harry Became Sally, that has been delisted from Amazon. We talked to him about that a couple of weeks ago. A Washington Post reporter manufactured a quote that Ryan T. Anderson said, LGBT equality is akin to what gave us the Holocaust. And that reporter, Michelle Borstein, continues to justify her characterization of Ryan T. Anderson's views in a quote that he never offered. He tweeted out yesterday, WaPo reporter continues to justify manufacturing a quote that in no way resembles my views, but I came by claiming it was so clear she didn't even bother asking me. And that's what Michelle Borstein tweeted out. I would have asked if I felt it wasn't clear. What's not clear in that video? He says his view of LGBT people and marriage explicitly there and in multiple op-eds. Well, no, his view is very clear. He believes and does not support marriage redefinition. And does not support men identifying as women and women identifying as men for the purposes of the conference of special rights and privileges. That's clear. But he never made that Holocaust comparison, and she won't recant. She just made up a quote. I would have asked him if I thought his views were unclear, so I just described my view of him to him.
Well, that's
journalism.
That's fraudulent. Well, that's not journalism. That's character assassination. Defamation of character.
For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Mark Hemingway, senior writer at RealClearInvestigations.com and book editor at The Federalist, TheFederalist.com. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, glad to be back on the show.
If it it sounds true, it probably is. Go with it.
Yeah, I'm afraid that passes for what a lot of modern journalism is these days. I mean, you know, you went through the facts a little bit about the Washington Post, you know, quote where they recently, you know, retracted a bit, but you didn't really begin to touch on what really happened. And so I'm just going to go through the sequence of events here
yeah.
for people so they understand. Washington Post took quotes from the office of the Georgia Secretary of State's office. In fact, it was the Deputy Secretary of State, Jordan Fuchs, gave these quotes to a Washington Post reporter about a phone call Trump made to Georgia's chief elections investigator. Now, the Deputy Secretary of State was not on the phone call where they got these quotes. They had a conversation with the person on the phone call and then relayed what they were told to the Washington Post reporter. So you have secondhand, it was a secondhand report of what was said on the phone call given to a Washington Post reporter. On top of that, the Secretary of State in Georgia was feuding publicly with Donald Trump. I mean, they were at each other's throats, and this was acknowledged in the original story. So you have secondhand quotes from the office of a political enemy of Donald Trump. Then the Washington Post gets these, what are supposed to be quotes directly from the president's mouth. From a secondhand source, they can't confirm them with additional sourcing. Then they still run with these quotes. They use these quotes in a news story in the Washington Post as a basis for saying the president potentially committed a crime. Then these quotes get used in the impeachment proceeding multiple times. There is absolutely no universe, and let me tell you, someone has a journalism degree, there's no universe where that circumstance means that story should have been published. Secondhand quotes about the sitting president of the United States from a political enemy with no independent confirmation, and that's what the Washington Post ran with.
But what's the consequence? Consequence is shrug our shoulders, all right, we retract it. All right, moving on.
They didn't even run a retraction, really. They just ran a lengthy correction at the top of the story. It's appalling. It's 2 months later after the fact, after perceptions have hardened, we've had impeachment, all these other things have happened. I mean, basically that story was key to a lot of the post-election narrative that was happening at the time. And again, whether they run a correction or not is irrelevant to the fact that the story never should have run, ever, under any circumstances. There's no ethical justification for running that story. It runs counter to everything you would ever be taught in journalism school, and I just don't understand how they continue to expect to do this and expect people to believe them. I mean, it's gone way beyond mere bias here. We're dealing with a situation here where I think a lot of people are just viewing this as straight up information warfare. And there's no other explanation really for what's going on. Whether this reporter meant to do this or whether the incentives behind the scenes were all aligned to push her to do this, it doesn't change the fact that clearly this was more about attacking Trump than it was about, telling the truth.
So you don't think any heads are going to roll because of this?
Oh, I'd be shocked. I mean, here's the thing. This came at the tail end of a Trump presidency where about every month a story that was anonymously sourced was blowing up in the faces of, a major news organization. I mean, this happened over and over and over again during the Trump presidency because they were so desperate to go after Trump that all of a sudden, the media industry before Trump came along had been getting a little looser about certain rules. But when Trump came along, anonymous sourcing became the news. And that's another part of what's happening here is on top of the Washington Post getting this story badly wrong, NBC, ABC, PBS, CNN, a couple of other, bunch of different other news outlets. After the Washington Post ran this story, a bunch of major news organizations actually, quote unquote, confirmed the Washington Post anonymous sources and these quotes. But they didn't confirm anything. Clearly, they were all talking to the same person in the Deputy Secretary of State's office, granting that person anonymity, and they were then, creating the impression that this was, the truth because a whole bunch of people confirmed it. When the reality is they were all being played by a political operation.
Well, I mean, this is, in journalism today, this is a venial sin. This is an immortal sin, like running an op-ed by Tom Cotton. I mean, that's when heads roll.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, that's exactly right. I mean, part of the problem here is that we have a situation where every newsroom in America has, zero ideological or diversity in any way, shape, or form. So there's no one there looking at stories like this, that's even maybe center-left that's going to look at a story like this and say, whoa, 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 maybe we should pump the brakes on this. It's more, the more exciting it is, great. The more that, you rush it to the front page.
Well, Trump sells newspapers.
Well,
I mean, people, it's clickbait.
Well, Well, I mean, I would say, look, well, yeah, maybe I shouldn't run this. But then, you know, one of the deans of the D.C. Press Corps, David Remnick, said, hey, this is a new paradigm for the press corps in the era of Trump. We're advocates now. We're not journalists.
There's definitely a lot of that, what's going on here. The economic business model behind a lot of journalism that existed for years, you know, it was already crumbling thanks to the Internet, but it certainly accelerated to a degree in the last, you know, decade, where when Trump came along, a lot of these newspapers all of a sudden were getting, you know, support from, you know, holding the government accountable from this, you know, excitable base of left-wing subscribers. And as a result, the papers have explicitly started catering toward a left, you know, an even further left-wing base than they already have. So, you know, news organizations like the Washington Post and the New York Times, where they were always left, but they understood that their brand, you know, was contingent upon retaining this perception of objectivity, all of a sudden they're like, no, you know, we're just going to, you know, subscriptions are way up and we know who's subscribing, so we're going to give them the news that they want to read rather than the news as it is.
Right. So it's the creative writing on the one hand, and then it's burying things that are inconvenient truths, to borrow a phrase from the great Al Gore, on the other hand. So, for example, if you raise any questions about anything that transpired in 2020, about the election, you're perpetrating the big lie. And so I'm loath to raise this development in Michigan. But in Michigan, this, I assume, will not be reported widely. Michigan Court of Claims Chief Judge Christopher Murray ruled that the Democrat Secretary of State of Michigan, Jocelyn Benson, broke the state's Administrative Procedures Act when she issued guidance regarding how absentee ballots were to be evaluated, and this was particularly with respect to signature matching. She broke state law when she issued guidance regarding how absentee ballots were to be evaluated. But if you question how absentee ballots were evaluated or anything else related to 2020 in any of the states that matter, then, you know, you're just a crackpot and a conspiracy theorist.
Well, yeah, that was one area where certainly the media just, you know, went, you know, completely down this, you know, ideologically blinkered rabbit hole. I mean, there are all manner of things that were done with regard to election rules that, as you point out, you know, were both, you know, dodgy and you know, considered completely taboo to question by the media. You know, the fact of the matter is that the legislatures are supposed to set the election rules, and across the board there were all manner of changes that were made hastily, either because of the pandemic or because the Democrats had this massive operation led by Mark Elias there, you know, the same man behind the Russia dossier in Washington, D.C., who was suing about every swing state, you know, 10 times so that they could change the election rules to be more favorable to Democrats. And almost never did any of those changes be, you know, processed through the legislature. I mean, it was always the government using these lawsuits or, you know, getting pressure from left-wing activists, you know, whether it was, you know, some elections board or whether it was the governor unilaterally acting to just go ahead and change the rules. Now, once upon a time, again, as these things were happening, they would have been a story. But instead, not only were they not a story, whenever there were obvious problems and irregularities, you saw all sorts of insane pushback. There was a, I don't know if you recall, during, you know, right around the time of the Iowa caucuses last year, there was a situation where a conservative group called Judicial Watch put out a press release. Yeah. Pointing out that 8 counties in Iowa had more voter registrations on file than they had eligible voters living in the county. And the pushback from fact checkers and other people was just absolutely insane. But the reality is that we know this is a problem across the United States, where states don't clean their voter rolls, and so they end up with, with an excess number of voter registrations, because like 10% of Americans move every year. And somehow it was completely taboo. Every fact checker was weighing in, all these other things, to point out that this wasn't true, and we had no reason to worry about elections, when the fact of the matter is anyone who studies election issues knows that having too many voter registrations in a given area is a consistent problem across red and blue states, you know, in the entire country.
Well, everything's back to normal again. I mean, except you can't go down the border and take any pictures or do ride-alongs with border security. Border enforcement. We're not there yet. But Jen Psaki is going to tell us when we are. Mark Hemingway, senior writer at RealClearInvestigations.com, book editor at TheFederalist.com. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
I haven't solidified my picks yet, but I'm thinking
Because you're going to share that with me, right? I mean, not for the office pool that we're doing, but for my other...
As long as you don't use it for the office pool.
Yeah, I won't.
You know, I'm thinking maybe a little rematch
between
in the finals. Michigan and Illinois.
Oh, no. Iowa, Illinois. Michigan.
I'm thinking Michigan. So I'm thinking Michigan, Illinois could be the final.
Nah, I'm Iowa, Illinois.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. If we only knew then what we know now, or if we only would have done more due diligence then, as opposed to what we're learning piecemeal now, most of us. Dr. Kerry Mullis is a 1993 Nobel Prize recipient in the study of chemistry. He's also the creator of the PCR test. He passed away in August of 2019, just months before, ironically, his invention would be used to test for COVID and its results to determine the lockdown of nations. And yet before his death, he spoke against his test being used in the manner in which it came to be used. Mullis notes how PCR tests can be amplified so much as to make them unreliable for diagnostic testing. Quote, with PCR, if you do it well, you can find almost anything in anybody. Because if you can amplify one single molecule up to something that you can really measure, which PCR can do, then there's just very few molecules that you don't have at least one single one of them in your body. So that could be thought of as a misuse of it just to claim that it's meaningful. It allows you to take a very minuscule amount of anything and make it measurable, then talk about it. Like it's important. See, that's just a misinterpretation. PCR testing, you want to say, it's a process that's used to make a whole lot of something out of something. That's what it is. It doesn't tell you that you're sick, and it doesn't tell you that the thing you ended up with really was going to hurt you or anything like that. Oh, boy. He also had this to say, and this is from an interview he gave back 25 years ago, mid-90s, about one Dr. Tony Fauci.
Uh-oh. What is it? What is it about humanity that wants to go to all the details and stuff and listen? You know, these guys like Fauci get up there and start talking. You know, he doesn't know anything really about anything, and I'd say that to his face. Nothing. The man thinks you can take a blood sample and stick it in an electron microscope, and if it's got a virus in there, you'll know it. He doesn't understand electron microscopy, and he doesn't understand medicine, and he should not be in a position like he's in. Most of those guys up there on the top are just total administrative people, and they don't know anything about what's going on the bottom. You know, those guys have got an agenda, which is not what we would like them to have, being that we pay for them to take care of our health in some way. They've got a personal kind of agenda. They make up their own rules as they go. They change them when they want to. And they smugly, like Tony Fauci, does not mind going on television in front of the people that pay his salary and lie directly into the camera. You can't expect the sheep to really respect the best and the brightest. They don't know the difference, really. I mean, I like humans. Don't get me wrong. But basically, the vast majority of them do not possess the ability to judge who is and who isn't a really good scientist. I mean, that's a problem. That's a main problem, actually, with science, I'd say, in this century, because science is being judged by people. Funding is being done by people who don't understand it. Okay, who do we trust? Fauci? Fauci doesn't know enough to, you know. If Fauci wants to get on television with somebody who knows a little bit about this stuff and debate him, he could easily do it, because he's been asked. I mean, I've had a lot of people... President of the University of South Carolina asked Fauci if he'd come down there and debate me on the stage in front of the student body, because I wanted somebody who was from the other side to come down there and balance my, because I felt like, well, these guys can listen to me, but I need to have somebody else down here that's going to tell me the other side. But Fauci didn't want to do it.
And again, he is the creator of the PCR test.
And that was 25 years ago, describing Fauci. Oh, boy. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Roger Klein. He's an expert with the Regulatory Transparency Project's FDA and Health Working Group, former director of molecular oncology at the Cleveland Clinic, former advisor to the FDA, CDC, CMS, and HHS. Dr. Klein, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. It's great you brought up Carrie Mullis, a very interesting character.
Well,
what did you think about what he said?
Dr. Klein, speak to Dr. Carrie Mullis.
Well, so Carrie Mullis wrote a very interesting book that I would highly recommend to anybody who wants a really, really neat read. And it's called Dancing Naked in the Mind Field. Terrific autobiography. Very, very interesting. So I pushed back a little on the notion that Mullis invented the test. What he invented was the technique of PCR.
Okay.
He discovered he's a brilliant guy. So that technique was later translated into testing that people like me do. So really smart guys like him came up with the technique. Maybe smarter people came up with the way to make the tests, and then people like me kind of run those tests, oversee the running, and interpret them. I think the point is well taken. You can with infectious diseases in a sense, COVID, the great example. And I've done a fellowship in microbiology and virology at the Yale, medical microbiology and virology. That was early on. And I think one of the points that he's making is just because you find, for example, a positive PCR test doesn't mean the person has, quote, disease per se. It simply means that material is there, and there is a clinical difference. It's important to understand these tests are highly sensitive, so we don't always know the implications. Like if you find 3 months later after somebody recovered from COVID, for example, you can find traces of potentially, you know, the nucleic acid, and it doesn't mean the patient's sick or infectious or contagious. It just means that you can find that material there. So I agree with the need for interpretation. You know, the criticisms of Dr. Fauci, I think we all understand. First of all, he's already up in years. He was a basic scientist. By reputation is really how he made his name. Not as somebody who was really on the front line managing epidemics. He's at NIH, not in the field. He's a smart guy, but he's one person. He's an excellent HIV researcher. He's mostly a bureaucrat now. He manages an institute. He can't have a lot of time to do other things. And I think those are political, even though they're not political appointments, there's a political aspect to those positions. So I think he's Fauci's one voice, and it's nice to hear it. But the notion that somehow we'd simply just take what he says as gospel and follow it, I think it's wrong.
But we do. I mean, he said double masks, and now people are walking around Chicago with 2-3 masks on.
Well,
you call him St. Fauci, Dan, for a reason.
The interesting thing about what Carrie Mullis had to say, well, two things. One, to your point, Dr. Klein, what he's talking about with PCR and what you were just describing with the actual testing, implementing the technique that apparently earned him a Nobel Prize, is something that has been raised during the pandemic. It's just been muted. But the whole idea of the accuracy of some of these tests, and are you misinterpreting, over-extrapolating from a relatively small presence, and not distinguishing between, you know, somebody who has a small presence versus somebody who, you know, you use the proper vernacular, but has enough of the virus to be considered a public health concern. I mean, all of those gradations were eliminated from the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the lay press, not necessarily
in the lay press. That's what I'm talking about.
This is one of the reasons that so many people say there are many more infections than cases, because people that get it, people are exposed and they're infected, but they don't ever get sick from it.
Right.
And
right.
So it, that, and, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, but I mean, yes, right. So the asymptomatic spread was underappreciated, just as we're sort of learning that the percentage of Americans who have natural immunity was undershot as well by Dr. Harold Hill over at the Center for Control and the rest of them.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you know, Kelly Mullis, we have to hit what his discovery. You cannot overestimate the impact it's revolutionized medicine across the board in every diagnostic area, whether it's, you know, infectious diseases, you have some cancer and other areas. So the magnitude of what he discovered is phenomenal. You it's impossible to overstate it. I want to be clear about that.
Yeah.
But you know, to the point about masks, you know, CDC came out with a study recently that looked at the entire period of the epidemic of 2020, and this got very little fanfare, but they looked at mask mandates and they found almost no impact. You know, it's very hard to do studies that would really isolate that as a sole. Usually there's more things going on, so as a sole factor, very hard to isolate, but there was no greater than a 1.8% I think decrease in the rate of spread. You know, fudging and factoring all kinds of statistical ways to try to isolate masks, which again it's hard to do. There were anomalies in those statistics generally that question reliability. For example, the deaths were higher, the reduction in deaths were 1.9 versus 1.8. It doesn't make a lot of sense during those periods because you would expect probably the rate of death probably wouldn't change, you know, wouldn't necessarily, it might lag and they also looked at restaurants and they looked at on-premise dining and they looked at they didn't distinguish inside and outside. And you know, there's time lags and weird things, but they found the effects were very modest.
I know, but Dr. Klein, let me interrupt here, because here's the problem with that, because something else that Carrie Mullis discovered, or at least seems to be ahead of the learning curve for the rest of us, at least he was willing to speak publicly about it, is that Fauci is not somebody that should be the Oracle of Delphi in the public mind. And what he's done, you just mentioned this, the study out of the Center for Disease Control. What he is doing then when he goes on these shows and talks about mask wearing and does the pro forma repetition of wash your hands, social distance, wear a mask, he is committing a sin of omission because he is not providing context that an agency he effectively represents has developed through research. He should be providing that sort of context to tamp down this misunderstanding that so much of the public has, fanned by political hacks, that the masks are some sort of panacea or force field around you that a lot of people believe, which is why they run around shaming everybody not wearing a mask every second of the day.
Yeah, so you're 100% right. I've never seen so much fervor for something with so little evidence.
Yes.
We've had a randomized controlled trial. You know, the Danish did. It didn't show anything. There have been two trials, one with COVID, one with another type. One was in Vietnam. We really don't have clinical data, clinical evidence, not barrier, you know, numbers of droplets with a mannequin, but real clinical evidence. We don't have the evidence that it has a substantial effect. There's no way, based on the study that was presented, even if there's an effect, it's small. There's no way it would impact the trajectory of an epidemic. There's an obligation of public officials to be truthful and to present the information in an unbiased way. And one gets the feeling there is a greater emphasis on trying to scare people into certain behaviors than there is in trying to let them make their own choices based upon accurate information.
Well, exactly. And it's always in the direction of lockdown. It's always in the direction of control over why doesn't Fauci, when he goes on, and it's not just him, but it includes him, and he is the sanctified one, so we're going to start with him. Why isn't he beating the drum as loudly for getting kids back in school, and hasn't he been over the last 6 to 10 months, as he is for something that's essentially a placebo, like mask wearing? I mean, there's John Bailey of the American Enterprise Institute has looked at 130 studies. Reopening doesn't lead to increase in cases in the community, and closing classrooms should be a last resort, over and over and again everywhere in the Western world. And yet they slow walk any comment about what's going on in Chicago or L.A. or San Francisco or New York. They've been nowhere really in this debate other than sort of forced pro forma admissions that the science suggests that classrooms, schools aren't spread. It's the safest place for kids. They say it once and then they walk away from it rather than hammering away at this the way that they hammer away at mask wearing and washing your frickin' hands.
because as I think Kerry Mullis suggested, and as you're suggesting, these are really political events. When somebody's getting on, you know, ahead of a government-funded research institute, getting on television, it's a political event. You know, they're now working with politicians. They're not independently representing that agency. It's always a danger when you have governmental funding and governmental support of any kind of scientific enterprise, and so I think you're right. You know, they're not. I don't believe that we're being treated like adults. And you know, as far as masks and these other lockdowns, you know, I mean, Rand Paul said that masks are about submission. Right. You know, and the question is, are they taking? You know, are people now taking something that is basically receding? And due to both vaccination and you know, infection, which we call natural immunity, but infection, are they taking this opportunity to pass $2 trillion bills to take away liberties, freedoms, to try to take, you know, change voting in America, to do all sorts of things to transform a wonderful country under the guise of COVID?
Exactly. And what President Biden is doing now, he's scaring people that say, you know, if you don't get the vaccine, you're going to be wearing masks, not for the next 100 days, for life, that we need you to get the vaccine. And if you don't get the vaccine, you're going to have a diaper on your face forever.
So what will happen if you don't get the vaccine? There's a good chance, although so many people are getting, we don't know for sure, but there's a good chance you'll get infected. And the vast likelihood is, certainly if you're not old and sick, is that you'll come through it fine. That's really what the truth is. The same way I did. I'm in South Florida right now. I'm in South Beach. I'll tell you what, you would not know there's a pandemic here. There's a lot of young people. They're out having a good time. They're living their life. They're enjoying themselves. Probably many of them have had COVID. If they haven't had it, they will have it, and they will not know they had it. They won't get sick. Right. They know this, and that's why they're behaving this way. I'm not seeing a lot of 90-year-olds here that have heart disease walking around.
All right.
I think, you know, out on Ocean Drive. So I think we need to be realistic. People are behaving in a manner in accordance with the risk.
All right, we'll let you get back to your spring break. We got the message. Dr. Roger Klein, expert with the Regulatory Transparency Project's FDA and Health Working Group, former director of molecular oncology at the Cleveland Clinic, former advisor to FDA, CDC, CMS, HHS. He knows what he's talking about. Dr. Klein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan. And Amy, is Nipple Rings Gambino preparing the Vincent the Chin Gigante insanity defense? I don't understand. Why is he wearing a blanket?
He got a little blankie, and people are, you know, just destroying him on social media, comparing him to Linus from the Peanuts. He was caught Saturday and Sunday over the weekend wearing a blanket, looking like the victim on his cell phone with Saratoga seltzer water in his right hand, the phone in his left hand, and looking very concerned and just pacing around the governor's mansion because he's acting weird. And yesterday he had a Wednesday phone conference.
Right, because they have social distancing protocols. You can't get within 6 feet of the governor.
No, he
especially
used
if
to,
you're female.
No, I see what you're saying there. But yeah, he used to have, you know, in-person press conferences on a daily basis. Now, since this happened, he had one last Wednesday. He had one yesterday. And nobody focused on the premise of the press conference, which was about vaccine rollout instead.
I wanted to ask specifically about the accusations you faced from Charlotte Bennett. She says that you asked her if she's ever been with an older man. She says you asked her if you practice monogamy. She says that you yourself said you were open to a relationship with a woman in her 20s.
Ew.
Did any of that happen?
John, as I said, the assembly has a review going on just the questions you asked and questions like it. And I'm going to respect the review, and I won't comment on issues that are subject to the review.
He sounds very quiet, very defeated Cuomo.
Well, what? You know whether you did those things or not, so say yes or no.
He won't. And then it got weird. So they had this operator who would take, you know, cue up the next reporter.
I'm not going to resign. Find out the facts, and we'll take it from there. Let's take one more operator.
Your next question comes from the line of Gwyn Hogan from WNYC.
Little
operator. He's a good old time. I thought maybe he would break in. He couldn't because the operator was a woman, but maybe to break into a little New Edition Mr. Telephone Man.
I mean, it was bizarre. That was the only time there was any levity to yesterday's press conference, phone conference, whatever that was.
Well, President Biden sat down with Clinton Foundation Donor Zero, as we know, and covered a range of topics, including Andrew Cuomo. And this is what Creepshow Joe had to say about Nipple Rings Gambino.
How about right now? You've said you want the investigation to continue. You saw Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer, Senator Gillibrand, majority of the congressional delegation, don't think he can be an effective governor right now. Can he serve effectively?
Well, that's a judgment for them to make about their state, where they can be effective. Here's my position. It's been my position since I wrote the Violence Against Women Act. A woman should be presumed to telling the truth and should not be scapegoated and become victimized by her coming forward, number one. But there should be an investigation to determine whether what she says is true. That's what's going on now.
And you've been very clear. If the investigator confirms the claims, he's gone.
That's what I think happens. And by the way, it may very well be there could be a criminal prosecution that is attached to it. I just don't know. But let the investigate. And I'm not, I don't know what it is. But I started with the presumption. It takes a lot of courage for a woman to come forward. So the presumption is it should be taken seriously.
Sure.
And it should be investigated.
Absolutely.
And that's what's underway now.
Absolutely. And so then the follow-up, never to come from Stephanopoulos, right. Of course, the follow-up is then you would support an investigation into Tara Reid's allegations against you, and we should presume that she's telling the truth, right, Mr. President?
Oh, George, he would step on a land grenade before he'd ask that question.
For more on all of this interesting developments and whether or not we should be rooting for Handsy Andy to survive or rooting for his imminent his demise as soon as possible, please be joined by Professor Nicholas Waddy. He's an associate professor of history at SUNY Alfred, and he has opined on the topic in The Spectator, in amgreatness.com, amgreatness.com. Keep on keeping on, Governor. Professor Waddy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you don't want to, the standard that President Biden has set forward, the presumption of belief, we start talking about presumptions in a legal context, even in a normative legal context. Usually the presumption is against for the accused in our free society, but that seems to be a bit confused with respect to Democrats here.
Yeah, I'm outraged that President Biden would say that. I mean, he's really overturning a key principle of American justice that you're innocent until proven guilty. He's saying that if a woman accuses a man of something, the man is presumptively guilty and has to prove his innocence. And that puts not only Governor Cuomo, but all of us in a very difficult situation. I think we all know that eventually the truth will probably come out, that some of what Cuomo is accused of is true, some of it is false, and some of it can't be proven either way. And so there's not going to be any clear resolution to this case in that sense. And not everything that he's accused of is sexual harassment or is criminal either. So, but anyway, to construct a standard that a man is presumptively guilty before you even know any of the facts is absurd.
I mean, except in the case of Biden, of course, he is exempt from that standard. But you go on to suggest that not only should due process norms be enforced with the Cuomo investigations, but also there's a very political reason, from your perspective, why you'd like to see Cuomo hold on as long as possible.
Yeah, well, I'm a conservative and I'm a Republican, and the truth is that the GOP is on life support in the state of New York, and we need a train wreck of a governor like Andrew Cuomo to breathe new life into the party and to give us an outside chance to win in 2022. And the truth is that the people of New York chose Andrew Cuomo. He was a terrible choice. He's a terrible governor. He's a terrible man. But we should have to live with that choice unless he is, you know, committed the equivalent of high crimes and misdemeanors and merits removal from office. So I'd like to see Republicans have a fair shot at winning the governor's mansion in 2022.
But speaking of the high crimes and misdemeanors, I mean, do you think anything will come out of the nursing home fiasco where, you know, changing numbers, covering up, sending infected people back to group homes and nursing homes?
That's a great question, because I think a lot of people regard that as the more serious crime here, or potential crime. I think some of us are a little skeptical and considering the possibility that perhaps there's some misdirection here. I think if Democrats, both in New York and nationally, had to deal with this nursing home issue, a lot of Democratic governors would be on the hot seat and their political futures could be in jeopardy. By destroying Cuomo on the issue, the rather nebulous issue of sexual harassment, Democrats might be able to avoid the nursing home issue, and they really shouldn't get a pass on that.
Right. It's not just nursing homes, but group homes, too, as we know and as we've discussed on this show. And you're right. The longer he's around, the more that issue is prominent and the more people say, well, what Governor Whitmer, what exactly did you do on this front? Pritzker, Murphy, et cetera, et cetera. But I want to go back to something with respect to New York Republicans, and you know that a wounded Cuomo presents a political opportunity. Maybe, but you know, we know something about this in Illinois when it comes to incorrigible electorates. I mean, Spitzer, Wiener, Cuomo. It doesn't seem like New Yorkers so much care about boorish behavior on behalf of their governors or high-profile elected officials.
Yeah, you're right. And I think the other consideration is that Cuomo has a year and a half to recover before he has to potentially run for re-election in November 2022. So I think, quite honestly, it is still more likely that Cuomo will be re-elected than that we will have a Republican governor in the state of New York. Having said that, a wounded Cuomo at least gives Republicans and conservatives a fighting chance, whereas all things being equal, they wouldn't have one. So.
Yeah. It's nice to have an albatross, right?
Right, exactly.
He is Nicholas Waddy, Associate Professor of History at SUNY Alfred. He blogs at Waddy, W-A-D-D-Y, waddyisright.com. Professor Waddy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, that Joe Cotton Ford commercial you just heard a couple minutes ago reminds me of something. I've been remiss. Thank Joe Cotton Ford and Tracy Kahn for getting my dad outfitted in a new ride.
Oh.
My dad went over
Larry's
there.
Larry's got a new car?
I called Tracy because I deal with the Chiefs, not the Indians.
Oh, right. That's how you roll.
That's right.
A pre-owned car or a new one?
He got a Ford Bronco over there at Joe Cotton Ford. Trace sent me a picture. And also, too.
Wait, your dad's tooling around in a Ford Bronco?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Is it white?
No, it's like rust colored.
Oh, nice.
I think, if I'm remembering the picture correct. I haven't given it a spin myself yet. But my dad, unsolicited, I just texted him after he went. I said, how'd it go? He said, what was nice was I never felt pressured at any time. Best car shopping experience for me ever. Thanks for setting it up. That's what he said. Unsolicited, hey. Seriously. And, you know, my dad is 140 years old, so he's bought a lot of cars in his life. So anyway, I just want to thank Tracy and the folks at Joe Cotton Ford. They're, you know, obviously we already know they're good people. They're advertising here, but we know Tracy and he took care of my dad. So there's a first person testimonial, unsolicited. All right. I got my bracket done.
Oh, okay. So what do you have? You know, and also, too, just enough about you.
Yeah.
About me. I don't need to cheat anymore. Why not cheat? I was going to take your advice for this other pool I'm in, but I did it on my own because I've got Iowa winning everything.
Of course. You do that every year.
I know. It's like Cubs
are going to win the World Series every year. Same thing Cubs fans do.
I've got Iowa playing Illinois in the final. What do you have?
It's interesting. All right, so my final four. I was thinking maybe the final game would be a rematch of the 89 Final Four. Remember who made the bucket for Michigan to tip Illinois?
I don't remember.
Sean Higgins, correct.
Oh, that's right.
A Final Four, Gonzaga versus Michigan, Texas Tech versus Illinois. I have Gonzaga, who I think is getting a bad rap as like, oh, they're soft, they're overrated. I don't think so. Gonzaga and Illinois in the final, and
please, who's winning?
Your national champion
is Illinois, right?
The Gonzaga Bulldogs.
Oh, come on!
You picked Iowa.
Well, I mean, it's Illinois.
Yeah.
You see their brotherhood out there? Like they're a team. They love each other. They breathe together. They move together.
Oh, by the way, speaking of basketball,
yes.
If you watch Last Chance U, I told you to watch it.
Right.
Last Chance U, their first basketball edition, East L.A. Community College. That's the team they profile, Last Chance U basketball. That's worth checking out, too. The coach there, Mosley, is really interesting, and it's another well-done series. If you like the Last Chance U football series.
Oh, Laney U, I love that one.
Yeah, check out Last Chance U.
And we're trying to get that coach on the show, right?
Yeah, we're working on it.
Okay.
All right, so let's end with staying local, since we're talking about the Illini. Arlington Heights' very own Sebastian Maniscalco. You know, his whole thing is, aren't you embarrassed? He does it, like, more funny and describing disappointment with people than I do, clearly. Uh-huh. That's why he makes millions of dollars on the comedy circuit. Here's his St. Patrick's Day message from yesterday.
I'm taking a big risk here. I don't even know if I could say this. This could jeopardize the whole thing right now. But I can't stay silent any longer. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Is that okay? Where's Patrick? Did he do something? Did we dig up something on him? What'd he do?
He's a scoundrel.
We okay with the color green? Is that all right? Someone get, like, hopped up if somebody takes out a green crayon? Four-leaf clover, we all right with that? Leprechauns, how about that? The leprechaun's got to go, right? Something wrong with him?
No, social justice Catholics protect the leprechauns.
Green and the brown beard. Someone got a problem with leprechaun? Pot of gold? He shouldn't have a pot of gold because that's what? He's fortunate and he worked hard and he made money. So he's got to give his gold to everybody else. You tell me what I can and cannot say. Aren't you embarrassed?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.